and they'll be crossing the state with more than 1,000 dogs next week. The annual spectacle of the Iditarod. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. One thing you notice if you follow this sport for any length of time, over time the mushers become more and more like their dogs. Our phone number, statewide and toll-free, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. Alaskans usually have plenty to say about the Iditarod. It's the subject today on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Providence Imaging Center, offering 3D mammography since January 2014, technology that helps the radiologists detect breast cancer. Learn more at provimaging.com. First National Bank Alaska, earning Alaska's trust for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, it was a great relief, I'm sure, to most when it snowed in Anchorage, and that meant that there would be snow to put on 4th Avenue for the ceremonial start of the Iditarod Trail sled dog race. And so on Saturday, they will run through town. And what will the mushers be thinking about? Well, they enjoy themselves, to tell you the truth, but also they'll be thinking about their dogs and hoping their dogs don't spook and that nobody gets hurt, and that it goes nice and smooth so they can get about the real business at the restart on Tuesday, because it's all about the edge in the sport of the Iditarod. It has been among the top 20 or so. It's been really tight, really competitive, and you don't want anything happening to your dogs on that ceremonial start, which doesn't really earn you anything. And so they'll be concerned, but also happy and enjoying it. And it's that time again, and we're here to enjoy the spectacle. So I'm glad you could join us on the program today. And we were hoping, really, over the years, I've tended to go more and more to talking about the dogs more than the mushers. And this year was going to be even more so because I had scheduled Dr. Mike Davis back on again, but he had to cancel at the last minute, which is really unfortunate because he's a wellspring of information about canine capabilities and performance, which continue to amaze him as he measures the performing sled dogs. And Mike will be up in Anchorage to participate in the Iditarod, but he's not here now, and he couldn't make it for the show today. So what I did is I called up Emily Schwing at radio station KUAC, our member station, in Fairbanks. Emily is going to be covering the Iditarod. You'll be hearing her reports in the morning and sometimes in the evenings. And she also covered the Yukon Quest. And she agreed to run to the phone and be on the show today. So, Emily, thanks for coming on. How are you doing today?
No problem, Steve. I'm doing great. How are you?
Oh, I'm just, the heartburn's over. Now we're just having a show. I'm expecting another guest is Ted Carasotti, who's been on the show in the past, the author of Merle's Way and now of Pucca's Promise. And his Merle's Way is, if you read this book, you were moved by it. It's about learning from your dog. And his new book, which just came out in paperback, and Ted probably will be calling in later on. He's basically subject to the vagaries of his airplane schedule. But it's Pucca's Promise, and it has to do with this issue of how well are we caring for our dogs as they age, because he has become convinced that when dogs are pets, they could be living longer and fuller lives if we just knew better how to take care of them. So it could be really interesting. But meanwhile, Emily.
Yes.
We had the Yukon Quest go by, and it had an unfortunate ending. I think everybody agrees, including the winner, Alan Moore. Do you have any update on Brent Sass and how he's doing now? after that big fall?
I have a little bit of an update, just mostly what everybody already knows. He did decide to withdraw from the Iditarod, mostly, I think, just for peace of mind and to make sure that his health was you know, good. I also think that what happened in this year's Yukon Quest to Brent Sass was pretty devastating and emotional for him. So I think he came to the conclusion that was probably within the best interest of him and his mushing career long term, as well as his dog team, to take this season off and sort of reevaluate how he does things on the trail and move forward in the future. Almost every musher I talk to says, you know, they don't train dogs to win one race. They train dogs to win many races. And so I think that that is very likely how Brent Sass was looking at dealing with the rest of his season after coming home from the Yukon Quest with a severe concussion.
Yeah. And, you know, with a concussion, I mean, realistically, he was talking about for a while about running with a helmet. I just think that's I'm very relieved that he's not going to try and do that, because one thing, when you have a concussion, you don't want to get another one.
Exactly. And, you know, I actually can't really speak to the whole helmet scenario, because I really haven't heard very much. But I also haven't checked in since I've been home from the Quest.
Right.
So, but it is something that I will continue to follow for sure.
Well, I want to thank you very much for those who don't know. We probably should say that it did turn out that Brent Sass, who could have maybe won the race with his strategy against Alan Moore, basically fell asleep and hit his head.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened, and you know, that's it's part of the race, and. It is a challenging sport. You know, you do stay awake for many days, all hours of the day. And I think a lot of mushers have sort of had their own accidents in similar ways. You know, staying awake for that long and working as hard as you do in extreme conditions can take its toll for sure.
Yeah, it's been talked about on the show by mushers from time to time. It's actually kind of funny. I mean, they talk about getting to the point of hallucinations, you know, about the point where you go across Norton Sound and you start seeing things that aren't there. And we all know that, and Jeff King will admit that this has been his Achilles heel. This is what always eats him up towards the end of the race.
Well, I also think that, you know, it does sort of mess with your race strategy in a different way, and that's efficiency on the trail. When you are sleep-deprived, you don't have a lot of wherewithal to really think through how you're dealing with things in checkpoints. So I personally have seen my own fair share of mushers come into a checkpoint and take, you know, 18 or 20 minutes when they really only intended to take 8 to 10 minutes to go through their drop bag. So it's part of the sport for sure. And, you know, a lot of mushers will tell you that that's the name of the game. You know, if you can sort of keep your wits about you even when you are at your most sleep deprived and challenged physically, you know, those are the people who do win the race.
We're speaking with KUAC's Emily Schwing. She covered the Yukon Quest. She will be covering the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race. And what, this like your third or fourth year on this now?
This is my fourth Yukon Quest, yep.
And so I really appreciate, I know it's, you know, this is not the best time to catch you and put you on the radio, because you need to relax, because you want to get rested up for this race that's coming up. But at the same time, we want to keep you in condition, because that's how they do it with the dogs. I mean, as it turns out, Lance Mackey showed that it's a valid strategy to put your dogs through that performance of the Yukon Quest and then bring the team back for the Iditarod. I mean, it's more and more people are doing it now.
Well, and yeah, I really think that there are a lot of mushers that are considering that is perhaps the way to get your dogs ready for the Iditarod. I will say, however, that these are two extremely different races. You know, the longest run between checkpoints on the Yukon Quest is 200 miles, and the longest run between checkpoints on the Iditarod is somewhere between 70 and 80 miles. So the two races just are extremely different in terms of strategy and how mushers devise their race plans is very different. So I think that for me, covering both of these races, it's what makes it so interesting, because they are so different, and so the stories are so different, and the you know, the strategy and the sport changes so much between the two races, and they're only, you know, 2 weeks apart. So it's very exciting to see. Especially with Yukon Quest mushers that come to the Iditarod as well, back-to-back in the same year, it's really interesting to see how they change up their teams and how they change up their race plans to deal with the two different trails.
Well, I'm thinking about Alan Moore right now, and I'm looking at the list of those who are signed up for the race, the Iditarod, from the trail committee, and I'm not seeing Ali Zirkle on there. I don't know if that's a mistake or what, but
no, Allie Zirkle is she's on the list. Actually, I'm looking at her name right now. And,
okay, good.
I would be shocked if she did not run this race this year.
Right. Because they have the same team, she and Alan, how do they work that?
Well, they actually they have a pool of dogs to choose from, and usually they run it like an A team and a B team. And the way that they're doing it this year is, you know, they look at the dogs and how they performed in the Quest, and they'll select their 16-dog team for the Iditarod from those dogs. I can tell you that it is very likely that Alan Moore's main leader, Quito, will run on Allie's Zirkle's team in lead this year. Now, that dog is a super special dog. She finished in single lead in the Yukon Quest this year. She's run all four quests with Alan, and she has run a number of Iditarods with Allie. So I believe she's a 7-year-old dog, and apparently she's just a go-to leader. And they're really hard to come by. So I know that dog will be on Allie's team. It's very likely. There's another dog named Scruggs, who's a team dog, and she'll probably be there as well. And they just sort of look at how the dogs are working together, and you know, when they come back from the Quest, they get a little bit of a rest, and then they start working them back in together and training here in Two Rivers, or nearby here in Fairbanks in Two Rivers, until it's time to head down south to the Iditarod start.
Yeah, you know, I don't even know how far back it goes, this idea of having a large enough kennel that you can run more than one team, but I know Boozer was among the leaders in that. And the reason for that being that the kind of long runs that sometimes are expected of your team, if a dog has never done that before, there can be problems, because they don't know what to expect.
Well, I can say that I think a lot of mushers are getting away from the kennels that have, you know, 150, 180 dogs. I think dog care in the 4 years that I've covered mushing has really changed, in that people are starting to develop smaller kennels, just because you can focus your energy on each individual dog a little bit better. So I know that Allie and Alan, they do not have a huge kennel, and I apologize, I should know better, but I can't tell you exactly how many dogs they have, but they don't have, you know, this enormous kennel with hundreds of dogs to pull from. I would be surprised if they even had 100 dogs, to be quite honest with you. And I think, you know, they're really into dog care and looking at dogs and communicating with dogs. And Allie actually told me on the Quest that she's a dog nerd. So
I tell you, this is absolutely true. I've seen this down through the years. Over the years, they get more and more like their dogs. Or it's a fact. I mean, Mackie is about 30% canine at this point.
Well, they do often in checkpoints eat like sled dogs. I can say that.
It's so cool having you on the show, Emily Schwing. But you are a talker, and I do want to make room for the callers. The phone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. It's pretty much whatever you'd like to discuss with regards to dogs and the Iditarod today. It's just always kind of a fun show to do. That's 1-800-478-8255, a local call on Anchorage at 550-8422. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And we're also hoping to hear from Ted Carasotti to talk about learning from dogs. And I think that's something that anybody experienced goes through, this kind of thing of, wow, there are hidden dimensions to these animals. And that was originally going to be the whole subject of the show. But I think it's still pertinent and still an available subject to be talked about. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. So, Emily, do you have your own dogs?
I have one dog. It's the perfect size kennel.
Well, you but you like the outdoor sports. I mean, that's kind of in your...
Oh, I do, actually. It's really funny. I am a pretty avid classic cross country skier, and I'm actually training for my own long distance race this winter. So what I really enjoy is I actually learn a lot about efficiency on the trail and developing race plans from the mushers that I work with when I cover the Quest and the Iditarod. So that's actually been quite interesting for me. It's something that was very unexpected that my own athletic endeavors would benefit from what I do professionally.
Yeah. You know, Craig Medved said a very similar thing to me years ago. He said, you've got to admire these athletes. They are athletes first and foremost.
It's true. And both dogs and I think mushers are not necessarily, and no offense to the mushers I know out there, they're not necessarily the most seemingly athletic people, but they are certainly some of the toughest I've ever met.
Yeah. But, I mean, the dogs themselves have these hidden dimensions of performance that sometimes...
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, there's tons of research going on with sled dogs in terms of recovery and how they recover so quickly and everything from nutrition to, you know, what actually happens to their bodies physically as they continue down a 1,000-mile trail or even a 300-mile trail.
Right. I think, you know, who's back this year, I notice, is Robert Sorley, who I think broke through some frontiers on that.
Well, you know, it's very interesting to talk about the Norwegians because they are coming and they are. It's funny. I've talked with friends about how the Norwegians are coming. The Norwegians are coming, and they're really starting to take a very serious interest in the two long distance races here in Alaska. They're actually the only 2,000-mile races in the world, and so I think we're going to start to see a lot more Norwegians show up. You know, for these races and see what they can do. I will say that I'm personally very interested in looking at how the dogs perform because there are different rules and regulations in Europe for sled dog races than there are in the United States. So just different kinds of medications that you can give your dog here in the U.S. that you can't necessarily give to a race dog in Europe and different methodologies. Also, I'm really curious about training in Norway because we have endless miles and miles and miles here in Alaska of trail and also in the Yukon, and the distances just aren't available for European mushers. So a lot of them come over and spend a year before they ever race just training here.
What was my impression from Sorley? Here's this guy who loves the sport, but at the same time, he's a fireman, you know, and we get, like an amateur in this sport, but he managed to win. And it was because he was able to get performance out of his team that nobody had been expecting. especially in terms of how long they would run between breaks, between rests. So this could be really interesting, I think.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he's a two-time winner, so he's certainly no rookie to the Iditarod. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see how his dogs do, for sure.
But what you always see is that everybody watches everybody else, and they pick up on anything they think they can use.
Well, it's really funny that you say that, because I had a really interesting talk with Hugh Neff. Gosh, I can't remember which checkpoint. Oh, I was in Eagle, in the Eagle checkpoint this year on the Yukon Quest. And, you know, Hugh Neff and Alan Moore and Brent Sass, they really pulled out far ahead of the rest of the field in the Quest early on this year. And they were coming out of a little hospitality stop called Trout Creek Cabin. And I guess Alan Moore has taught himself to take these, like, 15-minute little cat naps just to get a little bit of rest when he's on the trail. And so Hugh was telling me that that's something that he'd really like to learn how to do. And I think they all sort of take mental notes of each other and you know, make little lists and try to look at what each and every musher does differently.
What? They're picking up on my power nap trick? Oh, come on. Don't tell me that. Oh, man. Got no secrets anymore. Yeah. Well, hang in there with us, Emily Schwing at KUAC. And I'm so glad you could join the show, but I think Ted Carasotti has managed to get through by telephone. Author of Pucca's Promise, which is now out in paperback, and it's great to have you back on the show. Welcome, Ted Carasotti. How are you doing?
Thanks very much, Steve, for having me back on the show again. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, it's great to have you back on. We have a terrible phone connection, as you might suggest, but are you on the book tour? You're in the middle of traveling. I really appreciate that you were able to call us.
I'm actually in St. Louis today and Chicago tomorrow, and I'm calling you from my cell phone, and I wish I had a better connection. Let me try something. Is this any better?
Fantastic. Much better.
Okay. Let's go with this.
All right. Thanks, buddy. Well, okay, I have not read Pucca's Promise, but the last time you were on the show talking about Merle's Way, which was absolutely fascinating and compelling masterpiece that was a big bestseller, you were saying, well, what I'm working on now is this idea of geriatric care of dogs, and I kind of assume that's the book Pucca's Promise.
Yeah, and maybe I misspoke back then. It was while I was working on Merle's Door, or rather while I was on the book tour for Merle's Door, I was getting many emails from people who had read the book saying, gosh, I love the book. The ending was so sad. Why do our dogs have to die so young? Merle was not young when he died. He was 14. Of course, it was too young for me. It was too young for him. But many people had dogs who died at 3, 4, 5 years old. And many people, especially those who lived with golden retrievers, had their dogs die of cancer. And so after getting hundreds of these letters, I thought, you know, I should write a book about why dogs die so young and why so many of them die of cancer. So I spent from about the end of 2007 through 2012 researching and writing the new book, which is called Pucca's Promise. Pucca is my new dog, and the subtitle is called The Quest for Longer-Lived Dogs. And the book deals with the factors that's almost on everyone's list as to why dogs don't live long enough. And these would be too much inbreeding, poor nutrition, exposure to environmental pollutants, too many vaccinations, the effects, the detrimental effects of spaying and neutering on a dog's endocrine system and its defenses against cancer, and the shelter system in which too many dogs meet too early of an end in North America. So I spent probably 3 years researching all this, and then another 2.5 years of writing it, and Pucca's Promise came out last year, and many people have thought it to be the definitive latest scientific word on dog health and longevity, as well as another love story, how I got over grieving from Merle's death and eventually used what I was finding about dog health to locate, to search for, and then finally get Pukka in Minnesota and raise him. And Pukka is now unbelievably 5 years old. It's hard to imagine that the time has gone so quickly.
Yeah. We're speaking with Ted Carasotti, author of Pukka's Promise and Merle's Door. And it's great that you could join us. I don't want to keep you on too long because this phone connection is frankly absolutely wretched, but I did want to get you to kind of connect with this issue of sled dog racing and people racing dogs, and just to get how you felt about it. And if you hate it, you can say that.
Well, I don't hate it. Watching the dogs perform, it seems like a lot of them are having the time of their lives. And I have had readers write me saying that I should write a new book about how terrible sled dog racing is and how it's brutal to the animals and they're kept in awful conditions. And I haven't had the time to substantiate any of those claims. I think my biggest problem with sled dog racing is that dogs, when they're not racing, are often chained on their kennels. And I don't like dogs being chained. There's a section in Pukka's Promise that talks about all the benefits dogs have when they're off-leash and mingling with other dogs on their own.
Yeah, that is, that was very interesting. It's last year we had Zach Steer on, and we had a number of callers that called about that very same issue, and he said, this is something that it's not an issue that's going to go away.
It's not an issue that's going to go away, and I think eventually the sled dog community will have to address it in a way that the rest of us who don't race dogs can understand why sled dogs need to spend most of their lives on chains. I've spent a bunch of time in Greenland, and I have to admit readily that I've run dogs in Alaska. I've run my own team in Alaska when I was staying with people up in the Brookstick Range. They gave me a team of dogs, and I had a great time. And both there in Alaska and in Greenland, the dogs were pegged at night. They were chained up. And the way it was explained to me in Greenland was, well, if we didn't chain the dogs, there would be these huge dog fights. I've accepted that. I haven't researched it definitively enough in order to come up with a firm opinion and then make some recommendations.
Beautiful. That's very diplomatic of you, Ted.
Well, it's honest. It's not being diplomatic.
I know that.
I don't like to wade in and say things when I'm not familiar with an issue. The book I wrote, Pukka's Promise, is pretty controversial. I take the pet food manufacturers to task for making some pretty awful food for our dogs, and there is some very good food at the same time. But before I was willing to say such a thing, I spent 3 years researching the topic, visited rendering plants, visited a pet food factory, and was actually able to base what I was saying in fact. And so when it comes to sled dog racing, I'd like to do the same thing.
All right, Ted, we got a beeping coming in on your telephone. I think I'll let you go, but I think we'll say to be continued. You're a hard guy to get hold of, but I'm really glad that we did.
Well, thanks, Steve, so much for having me back on your show, and I can't wait to get back to Alaska.
Wonderful. Ted Carasotti, the book is Pukka's Promise. It's out in paperback. Emily Schwing is with us from member station KUAC. Hope you had a chance to get a cup of coffee or whatever, Emily, there, and get back with us. But I'm wondering if you had any thoughts on what he was saying about the tethering issue, because I know you hear it over and over again nowadays.
Well, and you do hear it, but I can say that there are also mushers who do not chain up their dogs. There are a number of mushers who keep their dogs in pens. I think also there's a lot of mushers who have learned that dogs need to be socialized, especially sled dogs, because they are handled by so many different people, and especially on these long races, in particular on the Iditarod, where they may see one vet, you know, in Squintna, and then they might see, you know, four or five different vets until Caltag before they see the first vet that they saw again, just because, you know, there is no road accessibility. I have seen in just the 4 years that I've been covering these races how dogs have changed socially. And, you know, when I first moved up to Fairbanks in the interior and sort of learned a little bit about mushing in 2006, I was sort of warned, oh, you know, sled dogs are so mean. But I haven't really seen that, to be quite honest with you. And I did spend a little bit of time working in a kennel down in Nenana just to learn about the sport and understand, you know, everything from what dogs eat to how dogs live in a kennel. And they are pretty social, and they, you know, just like my own pet dog, whose name is Ghost, you know, they like belly rubs and ear scratches and, you know, they're dogs.
They're dogs, and they're social, goddammit. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage of 550-8422, email talkatalaskapublic.org as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. There's a good feeling you get when you give, and each year more Alaskans are supporting things they love when they file online for their PFD. Alaskans like you donated $2.5 million last year to strengthen education, help families in need of food and shelter, and protect the most vulnerable among us. You even shared your permanent fund dividends with public radio to keep quality programming alive and well. This year, the PFD is expected to be a lot bigger. So come on, love Alaska. Pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
We'll see.
Thanks to Amy Ray of the Indigo Girls for that nice music break. We're talking about the dogs here on the Talk of Alaska leading up to the Iditarod Trail sled dog race. The mushers and their teams are arriving in Anchorage and getting ready for the ceremonial start. I think they have to, they have the banquet on Thursday, and I think they have to have a meeting on Wednesday, and the schedule is picking up for them. Your call is welcome here on the subject of sled dogs or dogs in general, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. We had a caller, Stephen, who we lost earlier. If you want to call back, that would be fine. And we have Emily Schwing on, a reporter for member station KUAC up in Fairbanks. And Emily, if all goes well, will be following the Iditarod as she did last year. And are there some things you're going to be looking for in this race based on what you saw during the quest?
I think a lot of things that I look for are just how, well, now I'm going to give away all my tells, but
Of course, that's what I do in this show.
What mushers are doing in checkpoints. Yeah. And I don't really want to say any more than that. But you know, you just you sort of watch what kind of snacks they're throwing down. You watch how many booties they're putting in front of teams. You look at run times versus rest times. This is actually a very complicated sport. It's not just hooking up a dog team and running down a trail. And over the years, you know, you just sort of learn. You also learn. You learn about specific mushers, you know. For example, in this year's quest, it was very clear from the start that Brent Sass would not stop in a checkpoint. He hates stopping in checkpoints. He loves to camp. And, you know, the further we got down the trail, the more I knew I would have to jump in and talk to him as he was going through drop bags, because there was no way he was going to come inside and sit down and talk to me. So you also can start to predict how much time mushers might rest in a checkpoint. So just from a reporter's perspective, you have to be a little bit strategic about when you catch them for an interview. Usually it's over a plate of bacon, which makes for an interesting sounding radio story, but it's always fun.
Well, they I guess, you know, first off, you're required really to be courteous and to let them take care of their business. I mean, it's just, you sign up, you're going to cover the race, you agree to that rule. So you need to catch them when you can catch them, but you do have to be a little assertive at times.
you do, and I have to say that, you know, for all of the very best, most successful mushers, dogs come first. And so I sort of follow that rule. You know, if I want to be a good reporter and tell the right stories, you do let mushers go about their business with respect to focus on dog care as they come into checkpoints and leave checkpoints. Because it is a race and they are sleep deprived, and I would feel extremely guilty if a musher, you know, forgot to booty a dog or forgot to take care of a sore paw or, you know, massage a shoulder because they were going to answer my questions instead. I've never run into that problem, but I do sort of, you know, wait and sort of hold back and make sure that they've looked over their teams before they've talked to me, because obviously I'm not their first priority, and I know that.
Yeah. But then again, on the other hand, you know, they tend to always say the same thing. Well, no, it's just a coincidence we're showing up here at the same time. I'm following my game plan. You know, that's not always true.
No. And any good musher is also something of a good liar. So they never give away their whole race plan. And it does take some digging to drag it out of them. But that's the fun part for me.
Well, we have a caller from Fairbanks. Steve joins the program. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Steve.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Emily. I just wanted to say that I think you're doing a great job with covering the Quest, and I'm looking forward to listening to following the Iditarod. But I wanted to touch up on what you guys were talking about earlier on sled dogs and keeping them tethered up. And, you know, there's reasons why some mushers get around it. I don't know how they do it. But I've just had a small team, and even with a small team, you know, you got, if you're breeding and you're looking to race, and you got males and females that are intact. So you got to prevent breedings that you don't want. And feeding time, it becomes a fight. And there's just a wealth of reasons why it's sometimes better to keep them tethered up. But that being said, you know, these guys are out running these dogs daily. And to the mushers who have the secret of how to do it without getting unwanted pregnancies and fights, well, they got to get on this radio station and tell the rest of the world.
Maybe it's a secret. I don't know.
I agree. I think that, you know, dealing with 16 dogs or even more than that on one team is, it's quite a dramatic experience, to say the least. And, you know, there can definitely be mayhem. I've experienced it. I think everybody who has been anywhere near dog teams and sled dogs for any significant amount of time has also experienced it. So, yeah, I mean, there are dog fights to deal with, and there are dogs in heat, and there are young dogs and old dogs and hungry dogs, and, you know, that's how dogs are. It's just the reality of having and running and managing a kennel.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, Steve, we talked about Gordon Haber's wolf research a few shows back, and one of the things that he said is there is not a feeding order for families of wolves, and you know that has just kind of stuck with me, that there's obviously the alpha and so forth like that, but apparently when they're feeding the wolves in the wild, there's no discipline of that sort.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I have a biology background, and I always just assumed that, you know, there's kind of some sort of alpha feeding habits there. But, you know, who knows? Maybe, you know, obviously Gordon Haber has more knowledge on the subject than I do. But you would think, you know, that, geez, they would you know, the strongest and the fittest eat first.
You would.
Now, I know in the wild sometimes, you know, there's, you know, maybe a wolf had eaten already or something. There's always different variables that you never really know about. But I'll have to check in on Gorbin's research.
Yeah. He's not around to tell us anymore. You just have
No. But his research is.
It is indeed. Steve, thanks for that great call, and I hope some people take up your challenge and tell us more, because I think this is kind of a, as I think about it, really kind of a frontier issue.
Yeah, and I know there's plenty of people out there that do it, and they're successful at it, but it is a lot of work. The little bit I did get out of the guys that do it, they, you know, it's constant work, and there's lots of people around to help with that training. So,
well, that's a very good point there. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not always a case for, you know, mushers that are out, you know, kind of by themselves with you know, someone who's coming up to live in a dry cabin and work for nothing and learn the sport, you know. So, you know, it's tough for him, but.
Yeah, I'm thinking of all our lower 48 listeners that have no idea what a dry cabin is.
Well, yeah. Maybe you can explain.
Maybe I don't need to, really.
Yeah. Anyway, Emily, keep up the good work. We think you're doing a great job.
Oh, thanks so much, Steve. I really appreciate it. Thank you for listening.
And I loved Steve's chorus of canines behind him as well. So you got any thoughts on that, on the dogs penned rather than tethered, and how they make that work?
I really strongly believe it's socialization. I know of one musher who has a kennel full of dogs, and half of them grew up in Fort Yukon, and half of them grew up in Two Rivers, and you can tell which dogs were raised where. And you know, the more time you spend with dogs, the more social they become. And I've learned this with my own dog. I have a 4-year-old sprint sled dog, and when I first got her, she was shy, and she grew up. She was sometimes chained up next to a dog box, and sometimes she was in a pen. And you know, when 4 years ago, when she came to live with me, she was very shy and didn't really want to have a lot to do with people. But now I can't really keep her from running up to people and saying hello, which poses its own problems. But you know, I spend a lot of time with her, and my hands are always on her, and she's always, you know, with me. And she's more or less a house pet. We do ski door on occasion, and she runs with me. But, you know, I have learned that, you know, other mushers do the same. They really spend time with dogs. And you can tell which teams are really get a lot of attention and really get a lot of hands-on time with their mushers.
Yeah. Boy, you saw that. And that's one of my first observations when I started watching the sport as a reporter was Susan Butcher and the difference. I mean, just watching her with her animals was, she was very doggy. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Did I mention the phone number, 1-800-478-8255? If you're going to call, do now, because we're running out of time. Dave joins the program from Cordova. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Dave.
Yeah, good morning, Steve, and Emily, too. Thanks. I had a pretty extensive history with dogs back in the 60s and 70s, everything from training for sprint races to sitting around the yak with old Joe Reddington on the banks of his homestead there and talking about the Iditarod before it happened. But I guess I missed if there was a distinction being made between kenneling and being tethered, and was there anything about having them loose in an isolated property mentioned?
Dogs running free?
Yeah, there we go.
Well, why can't we? Why can't we, Dave?
Yeah, exactly, Bob. but we've got set netting and take the core of the team with us, you know, say the west side of Cook Inlet. And the only real issue we had then was when they got loose and got into porcupines.
Whoa.
That was huge. So we tended to keep them as close as possible, and They bonded effectively, but we also had teams that were made up of other people's culls, and sometimes they just never would get along, you know, and it was just, you just had to keep them separated on that basis once you figured out who was rivaling whom for whatever dominance they desired. In fact, we only had one dog that would eat Wolverine. He was generally the instigator of everything within the team if it was going to go wrong. But, it's interesting to see the evolution of this and the dog science. I'm learning stuff today that I'm fascinated by. And I guess that was about the extent of my comment was great to see it advancing as it is, and thanks for all the good information.
Yeah, well, you got that rare experience of sitting there with Joe talking about it before it even existed. I got a little taste of that when Jerry Ritter produced a piece on how the military assisted in actually going out and reconstructing that trail, finding where it was. I mean, they had to go out and resurvey the thing. It was really interesting, and it was no small accomplishment.
No, it's something which pulls the state together as a rule, and it seems to be such an anomaly these days. It's everybody's kind of on the same plane and focused as a state, whereas in the meantime we seem to be off squabbling over everything else of inconsequence generally. So, but, yeah, thanks again.
Okay, yeah, hey, I will tell you this, you know, as a journalist, it's a great relief to me to just devote all my attention to dog mushing. Emily, it's probably more work than, I mean, obviously you must enjoy it.
Mushing dogs or covering mushing?
Covering the mushing of dogs, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, what Dave was pointing out is that, you know, when you know, you're in the middle of the legislative session, there's just one kind of, you know, fighting after another.
Right.
You know, and we get to all watch these magnificent animals and these people.
Well,
that handle
I mean, I definitely hate to rub it in for all my fellow reporters out there in the Alaska Public Radio Network,
oh,
but
go
I'm
ahead.
Certainly, I'm certainly the luckiest.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, there, you know, there's. There is not another reporter in the world that gets to cover the things that I get to cover for 2 months out of the year. So it's truly just it's very exciting, and it is a whole lot of fun. It's a ton of work, but I really enjoy it.
Have you mastered the power nap?
No, but I have mastered powering through.
Yeah, well, you kind of almost have to for sure. I've witnessed that myself. Yeah. Let's go down to Skagway, and Nala joins the program. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Nala.
Hi, Steve, and I forgot your name. But
Emily.
Pardon?
It's Emily.
Emily, you're just most just marvelous host today. I just was remembering a time about 10 or more years ago. I got to spend a day with Frank Turner in the Yukon. And I just went out there for an hour and ended up being invited for dinner and pizza and sunset and runs with the dogs and time with the puppies. And when Frank, right at sunset, he had his workers that ran the dogs and took care of them all day, and the puppies had their separate yard with a wheel and all that. And the dogs were tied up to kennels, but they were happy dogs. And there, I think it was about, I can't remember, it was 100 or 150 dogs in his yard at that time. But they were all yapping and talking all day. He steps out there at sunset, and he just stands there quietly. Every dog in the yard, two eyes from every dog right on that man, and quiet. Oh, there wasn't a sound to be heard. Now that is the depth of that interaction. And after talking with this man, it was an amazing experience.
Well, that's an eloquent description, Nella.
Well, thank
Steve,
you, Steve, for all your
just,
good work.
Emily, go ahead.
Yeah,
Emily,
I wanted to add that, you know, I felt like I was really lucky to get to talk with John Schandelmeyer quite a bit during this year's Yukon Quest. He's run the race a bunch of times. He's never scratched, and he's finished 16 times in the race's 31-year history. And he has a really interesting way of going about raising dogs. Almost all of the dogs that he ran, well, at least half of his team this year, were rescue dogs, and he's really focused on rescuing dogs. And he doesn't discipline dogs, and he doesn't raise his voice with his dogs. And, he said something at the finish banquet at this year's race that I also found really interesting, which combined with how he deals with dogs is really telling about at least the Yukon Quest, which is that he'd like to see that race marketed not as the toughest race in the world, but as the one of the races that runs through the most hospitable part of the world, and I really feel like that is one of the reasons I love covering the Quest, is because you do get to go to all of these communities, and you know they are very warm and friendly, and that attitude, that spirit of the North, is part of what makes the Quest so special. And you know, the best mushers and my favorite mushers to cover really sort of emulate that feeling. And you know, without sounding too cornball or cheesy, I really feel like there is some truth to that.
But you wouldn't want to miss Tecotna now, would you?
I wouldn't want to what?
You wouldn't want to miss Tecotna.
No.
I just want to get that clear.
No, they have great pie.
Nala left us. But what a wonderful observation it was, the Vespers of the dog lot. And indeed, that's the world of the canine is the world that we all, I think that's where all the magic comes from, and certainly where all the dog power comes from to make this race happen. You think about 1,000 dogs, and you think about all the volunteer effort that goes into this. Mike Davis was too overscheduled to be able to make it onto the show, but you can bet he's going to, you know, come and be here for the race as much as he can. And so it is. He said, you know, vets fight for the right to be able to be part of this thing. It's just, it's quite a massive thing it's really become.
Well, it's also a really massive undertaking, particularly with the Iditarod, because there is no road access. So logistics is extremely challenging, just because there are so many checkpoints that are only air accessible, and there is such a great movement of people and supplies and drop bags and food, and you know, to bring all of those people, a couple hundred people, into you know a village and essentially double that village's population for you know, up to 4 or 5 days, maybe a week, is pretty overwhelming. But I you know, for some of those communities, it's the one time of year that, you know, there is a whole lot going on. Like last year, one of my favorite moments from the Iditarod last year was in McGrath, where there was just a whole raft of little kids running around as, you know, mushers were coming through the checkpoint, and the first 10 or so blew through, and, you know, they're just waving these little pieces of paper wanting everybody's signature, and just so excited to have these new people and all these dog teams coming through. And it was just really fun to watch these little kids running around just begging for autographs and that kind of thing. And there are some mushers who bring candy with them, which is always really fun. And, you know, I have to say that I was extremely impressed with Lance Mackey in McGrath, because he was really in a rush and wanted to keep up with the front of the pack. But he did take the time to talk with one little boy in particular who was very tiny. And so Lance got down on his knee and just sort of talked with him about, you know, sled dogs. And
all right, Emily. Emily, thank you so much for being with us on the show.
Sure, thank you.
Thanks to Tristan Sammons and Dave Waldron and Josh Edge. And I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. There's a good feeling you get when you give, and each year more Alaskans are supporting things they love when they file online for their PFD. Alaskans like you donated $2.5 million last year to strengthen education, help families in need of food and shelter, and protect the most vulnerable among us. You even shared your permanent fund dividends with public radio to keep quality programming alive and well. This year, the PFD is expected to be a lot bigger. So come on, love Alaska. Pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.